Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, to ask a question, press star and the number one on your phone and record your name at the prompt. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the call over to Mr. John Bateman. Thank you. You may begin.
All right. Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email at nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations, followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. One note, the link to the online presentation that was included in the media advisory has since been updated, so I'll give it to you over the phone and you may want to jot it down. I'll read this twice. The online presentation can be found at https://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/sotc/brief/20202220.pdf. And I'll repeat that one more time. https://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/sotc/brief/20202220.pdf. And with that, I want to introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Karen Gleason, a climatologist with NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the January U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the latest drought monitor update. Our second presenter is Dr. Eric Anderson, a physical scientist at NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, who will provide an update on the record high water levels and winter ice coverage of the Great Lakes. And our third presenter is Matt Rosenkranz, a meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña update, as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks for the next 3 months. Our first speaker will be Karen from NOAA.
Thank you, John, and thanks to everyone for joining our call today. Let's turn our attention to slide two, and we'll begin by looking at the global temperature for the month of January. Looking at the global land and ocean combined, it was 1.14 degrees Celsius or 2.05 degrees Fahrenheit above average, which translates to the warmest January on record, which is a 141-year record right now. Looking at global land only, it was 2.12 degrees Celsius or 3.82 degrees Fahrenheit above average, which also was the warmest for January. Looking at global ocean by itself, it was 0.78 degrees Celsius or 1.40 degrees Fahrenheit above average, which translates to the second warmest January on record. Looking at individual continents, we saw that South America, Europe, Asia were each second warmest on record for January, and special regions that we track, including the Caribbean and Hawaiian region, they were both second warmest on record in January, and Oceania ranked third warmest. Looking at our temperature departure from average map on the left side of the slide, we most notably see the large, very warm departures that occurred in Eastern Europe and Western Asia that were 5 degrees Celsius or larger departure from average. We also notice a cooler than average departure across Western Canada and across Alaska that was 4 to 5 degrees Celsius or more below average. Also of note, we see that the contiguous U.S. or the lower 48 was notably above average, as well as much of eastern Canada. Some cold areas to note were across India, the southern Indian Ocean, and parts of the southeastern Pacific. Turning our attention to the map on the right, our temperature percentiles map, what this shows us is by taking the temperature departure from average for January on the left and comparing it to its 141-year history for each grid box, we sort each of the values, the departures from coldest to warmest, and we assign it a rank or a value, and anything in a blue shade would be in the lowest third of the distribution or cooler than average. Anything in the white shading is in the middle part of the distribution or near average, and anything with a red shading is in the warmest third of the distribution, which equates to warmer than average, all the way up to record warmest. And so looking at that large area in the departure from average map on the left-hand side compared to its percentiles, we see that it was warmest on record for a smaller portion of that area, most notably across Scandinavia and parts of Europe. The rest of that area was much warmer than average. So they've actually seen more extreme temperatures throughout that portion of the globe. Also, across Canada and Western Canada and Alaska, we noticed for Canada it was near average, and for Alaska it was cooler than much cooler than average. Also, note a large area in the South Central Atlantic was ocean was record warmest as well, and the larger area of below average temperatures from the map on the left translated to cooler than average and much cooler than average temperatures on the right in the Southern Indian Ocean. Turning our attention now to slide number 3, we take a look at global temperature from a slightly different perspective, and we're comparing it to previous years. So as I said, it was the warmest January on record, and we exceeded the previous warmest January on record in 2016 by 0.02 degrees Celsius. So you see a black dot on the plot on the right side of the slide. And we also see it compared to the other 9 warmest years on record. So one way to look at this, if you're looking at annual temperatures, is that we completed the first lap in a 12-lap race, and we are in the lead after the first lap. According to our probability statistics, it's virtually certain that 2020 will rank among the top 10 years on record. Breaking that down further, we have a bar on the bottom of the graph that each tick mark denotes a 5% chance. So we see that there is almost a 50% chance that it would be the warmest year on record by the end of December. There's also a 98.55% chance that it will rank among the top 5 warmest years on record. And there's a 95% confidence interval around a rank from warmest year to 5th warmest year on record. Looking at slide number 4, we're looking at a time series of those temperature departures from average, but with a slight different flair. What we've done here is we have applied NOAA's definition for an El Niño month or a warming in the central and eastern Pacific Ocean. Above a certain threshold, they declare an El Niño month. So our bars in red are El Niño months. La Niña is the cooler waters in the central Pacific and eastern Pacific, and those bars are denoted by blue. The gray shaded bars are neither El Niño or La Niña, and we call that El Niño Southern Oscillation or ENSO neutral months. And so in general, what you see from 1950 to the present, these are monthly departures from average. We see a general increase or an uptick in temperature. And what we like to compare this to metaphorically is like going up an escalator and taking a ride. When you have an El Niño year, typically we see that it bumps up the temperature a little bit, the anomaly. And during a La Niña year, we see that the temperature tends to be a little bit lower than the overall trend upward, which is like jumping on an escalator for an El Niño month or crouching down for a La Niña month. If we look at the most recent month at the very end, the very right-hand side of the slide, we see that we are in that ENSO or El Niño Southern Oscillation neutral phase, which Matt will talk about in just a little bit here, but it is the highest departure from average that we've seen since 1950 that is ENSO neutral. The only Januaries that we've had that had global temperature departures greater than 1 degree Celsius occurred in 2016 during an El Niño month, which tends to be a warmer period. and in 2020, which, as I said, we're in an actual neutral month. So we're in sort of new territory here with a new record during a non-El Nino month. All right, let's turn our attention now to slide number 5, and we'll come a little closer to home here. In the lower 48, that for January, the temperature average was 35.5 degrees Fahrenheit, which was 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit above average. This translated to the fifth warmest January on record. Looking at the temperature map, rank map on the left-hand side, we have 126 Januaries now to compare, and we see that above average to much above average temperatures blanketed the entire lower 48. The warmest departures from average, or at least rank-wise, occurred across the Great Lakes, the good portion of the eastern seaboard, and the southern and central plains. Michigan ranked fifth warmest. Wisconsin and Rhode Island ranked sixth warmest. Of note, there were no average or below average ranks on this map, and if you were to look at our 5-kilometer gridded product, we did not have any below average grids on that either. So usually we'll have at least pockets of warmth or cold, even if one warmth or cold dominates. So it very much so was a blanket of warmth this past month. Looking at our residential energy demand temperature index, or as we call it, the REDTI, it was about 29% below average, which translated to the third lowest on record. So for folks that heat their homes in the month of January or are used to having higher energy bills, it's likely that they didn't have to use as much energy to heat their homes and to keep them warm. So that's a good point. Looking at precipitation, or the map on the right-hand side, on average for the lower 48, it was 2.70 inches, which was 0.39 inches above average. This is still in the near average range, but as you can see from the map, there were definitely areas that were above average and areas that were below average. The above average areas occurred across parts of the Northwest, the central and southern U.S., portions of the Southeast and the Great Lakes. The state of Washington ranked fourth wettest. Oklahoma ranked sixth wettest. The drier than average areas were present across parts of the West and the Southwest, the state of Florida, and portions of the Northeast. And most notably, it was the sixth driest January in Rhode Island and the 10th driest for the state of Massachusetts. Looking at slide number 6, we'll take a look at the current U.S. drought monitor, which was released this morning. Approximately 9.6% of the contiguous U.S. is currently in drought. This is about a percentage point less coverage than what we saw at the very end of December, beginning of January. There were improvements that we saw in parts of the Southwest, specifically the Four Corners region, and across the state of Washington. We saw drought moderate drought in California, and we also saw an intensification of drought across portions of central and southern Texas, even though the extent of the drought contracted. So the overall footprint got smaller, but what was in drought actually got further entrenched in drought. Looking outside of the contiguous U.S., we saw drought improvement across Hawaii and elimination of drought across Puerto Rico. And the multi-year drought that we've seen across the state of Alaska, specifically the Panhandle region, was also eradicated during the month of January, which is very good news for them. And with that, I will turn it over to Eric.
Great. Thanks, Karen. So if you please turn to slide 7. In January, we had record-breaking month for water levels and ice cover in the Great Lakes. As a reminder, the Great Lakes are influenced by larger climate patterns affecting North America and the world. The Great Lakes are the largest freshwater system on Earth, so they contain about 20% of the world's surface freshwater, or 95% of the freshwater in North America. And they have a vast coastline that stretches across both the U.S. and Canada. You can see here a rare but relatively cloud-free image of the Great Lakes from January 20th of 2020. If you turn to slide 8, first I'll call your attention to 3 graphics on the left, which focus on the recent temperature and precipitation highlights in the Great Lakes. Now, high water levels are the result of seasonal or even multi-year conditions. They don't happen just overnight. In that respect, 2019 was the wettest year on record in the Great Lakes region. Continuing with that trend, January of 2020 had above average temperatures and precipitation, as noted by Karen previously. Now, typically, this is the time of year when water levels decline in the Great Lakes, but we didn't see that happen this year as a result of increased precipitation and higher air temperatures that lead to generally lower evaporation. Both of those combined lead to the higher water level conditions that we're currently in. Turning to slide 9, you can see this is a time series plot of water levels for all 5 Great Lakes. You can see the variability of the lake levels. So these are monthly water levels over the period of record dating back to 1918. Now, while lake levels are variable in the Great Lakes, they typically decline in the fall and winter and then rise in the spring and summer as melting snow and increased rainfall replenish them. Now, broader fluctuations take place over longer periods. So you can see lake levels surged in the 1980s before dropping sharply again in the 2000s. And we are now in a period of rise again over the last 5 to 7 years in the Great Lakes. Each of the 5 Great Lakes broke monthly lake-wide average water level records. The high water level records at some point in 2019, shown here in the red circles at the right of the plots. In 2019, Lake Erie, in fact, reached its highest lake-wide average water level of all time, going back to 1918. Currently, water levels continue to be high for all 5 Great Lakes, either at the record highs for January or just below the record. So in January 2020, Lake Superior, Michigan, and Huron broke their January records for water levels, where Lake Erie and Lake Ontario were 2 and 4 inches below their January record highs, respectively. Now, in terms of ice, if we turn to slide 10, the average maximum ice extent occurs in the Great Lakes in late February or early March, so right about this time of year. In 2020, so far to date, the maximum ice extent for the region occurred on February 17th at an extent of 18%, as you can see in the graphic on the top right showing that 18% coverage. As you can see, 18% is much lower than the long-term annual maximum ice coverage in the Great Lakes shown in the bottom plot. That long-term average is 55.7% coverage compared to this year's 18% so far. Now, in January, Lake Erie had its lowest January maximum ice cover on record, a record that goes back to 1973, and all the other Great Lakes saw low ice in January as well. Turning to slide 11, this winter, due to low ice extent and high water levels, the Great Lakes region has experienced hundreds of millions of dollars in damages to coastal infrastructure, including roads, marinas, water treatment plants, waterfront homes, and parks. In years of low ice cover, the high water levels are particularly devastating because ice serves as a protective barrier to the coastline. So without ice, typical winter storms, common winter storms, can produce larger waves than under conditions with ice. Those larger waves can impact the shoreline, cause erosion, and cause more coastal inundation underneath periods of high water level conditions where that water is able to do damage further inshore than when the water levels are lower. For example, on January 10th and 11th of 2020, a winter storm slammed into the southwest shore of Lake Michigan with winds gusting to near 60 miles an hour. The waves reached 16 to 22 feet from Chicago to Milwaukee, and significant flooding ensued. This included damage to docks, collapsed docks and fishing piers, severe erosion and flooding, as well as closed roads and ports. So what does this mean looking into the future? The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers forecasts have predicted that lake levels will not drop significantly anytime soon. In fact, over the next 6 months, all of the lakes except Lake Ontario are forecast to set new record high monthly water levels in at least one of those months. The reason for this is because as we head into spring, we typically see a seasonal rise on the Great Lakes due to increased rainfall, melting snow, and increased runoff. And we don't expect to see evaporation play a major role even underneath the low ice conditions that we're currently experiencing. And with that, I'll pass it over to Matt.
Good morning, everyone. This is Matthew Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. So first slide here, slide 12, has the in the upper left image, there's an image for the sea surface temperature anomalies. So that's the sea surface temperature departures from the long-term average. It does show some that the near to above average sea surface temperatures for are in place across the equatorial Pacific Ocean. There's one small area below normal temperatures, right about 120 degrees west, but that seems to be quite transient and based on monthly variability rather than something that's going to persist for many seasons or even many months. The atmospheric conditions over top of the ocean, they are currently reflective of anti-neutral conditions. So we don't see a lot of convection and a lot of thunderstorms building over the central Pacific. The thunderstorms that are building there, they are over right near the dateline, so they're a little further west of the core El Nino regions. And they are current thunderstorms are really associated with what we call the Madden-Julian oscillation or intra-seasonal oscillations that vary on monthly timescales rather than seasonal timescales. And that should be coming, that should be fading out in the next 2 to 3 weeks. So overall, the El Nino forecast going forward, given that the atmospheric conditions are currently ENSO-neutral, and we do have monthly timescale fluctuations that are going to be up and down throughout the next months, we are expecting ENSO-neutral likely to persist through the northern hemisphere spring. And then as we go throughout the summer of 2020, ENSO-neutral is the most likely single category all the way out through the end of the period. So through summer 2020, so that's the official ENSO forecast is for neutral. Going to slide 13, the monthly forecast for March, reflecting of the intra-seasonal conditions, that would actually have a what we call a teleconnection pattern, which is where the atmosphere over the tropics kind of shakes the atmosphere and sends waves across the northern Pacific, and then those kind of impact the North American climate. The patterns we noticed in the tropical Pacific, as well as the patterns we noticed in the northern Pacific, kind of in the Gulf of Alaska, they would support generalized high pressure over the western part of the U.S. and generalized low pressure over the eastern U.S. And that low pressure can tend to drag some cold air southward out of Canada, and that can impact the March temperatures in the eastern part of the U.S. It's currently forecast, especially the first week of March, could be quite chilly into the southeast or below normal temperatures in the southeast, not necessarily chilly, depending on where your reference point is. For the western U.S., that high pressure in the west would favor above normal temperatures. There's also some potential feedback from some low snowpack amounts as the Sun of Sierras and the central part of Nevada have had lower precipitation, they are forecast to have below normal precipitation for the month of March. So that low snowpack can affect a lot of the terrain. Any of the higher terrain out there will typically have above normal temperatures, they have low snowpack. Also, the west coast of Alaska, we are forecasting above normal temperatures, especially in the southwest parts of Alaska where the ice is the ice edge is about median for the month. But with the ridging and the high pressure out over the west, you would expect some of that ice edge to retreat back potentially slightly earlier than average. So that would open up the west and north coast of Alaska to potentially more above normal temperatures. So that's why we tilted our odds towards above normal temperatures there. That ice edge retreat can also allow for above normal precipitation there. Colder into the eastern U.S. would also support below normal precipitation from the Great Lakes down into kind of middle Mississippi Valley, but then those cold fronts would tend to settle across the southeast, favoring above normal precipitation from the southeast and Gulf Coast into the state of Florida. Moving to slide 14, so as we get into the seasonal forecast for temperatures for March, April, and May, our highest odds are on the west coast of Alaska for above normal temperatures there. By April and May, we should have a meltout of the sea ice there, and that is typically happening earlier and earlier with the warmer temperatures that we are experiencing. So that has a large tilt towards above normal temperatures. Switching to over the contiguous 48 states, the highest odds for above normal temperatures are in the Four Corners region, and then kind of sliding southward over to Texas, then over to Florida. Those are where the trends are strongest for this time period, as well as the drought conditions that were mentioned earlier in the period. In the Four Corners region, again, a lack of snow can kind of elevate temperatures into March and April. But on the contrast, we do actually see some potential for cold air to come, or cooler than normal air to come into the northern plains. 15-year trends show a cold signal in the Montana and North Dakota, as well as some of our dynamical models. They also show some below normal temperatures kind of coming down into western South Dakota, into eastern Montana as well. A lot of that is reflected, could be reflected in the short-term period, so that March could be, that colder period from March is really kind of setting the stage for kind of a cooler March, April, May forecast, with some of that in the northern plains and some of that bleeding down into the central, middle Mississippi Valley. For precipitation, we are actually favoring above normal precipitation for a lot of the eastern U.S., basically from the Mississippi Valley to the East Coast. That was in a lot of the dynamical model forecast we have, and as well as if we have a wet March there, so we have some of that trough in the eastern U.S., it would be a dry March in the Great Lakes, but we are forecasting a good return of moisture in April and May. We are forecasting dry conditions for California and the desert southwest for March, April, and May, and a lot of that is conditioned on March being drier, because April and May tend to be dry across Southern California and into Arizona and southwest New Mexico. So moving to slide 15, that precipitation forecast, slide 14, please, and slide 15 in the drought outlook, where the drought outlook with the dry conditions forecast along the west, there's a lot of persistence forecast and even drought development forecast from Washington, the eastern parts of the state of Washington, and then central and western Oregon, and probably about two-thirds of the state of California, with the exception of the southern Sierras and southern California. But the rest of the state of California, kind of northern California, central California, San Joaquin Valley, and even down to Los Angeles, are forecast to experience some drying conditions through and potential drought development through the end of May. There should be some drought relief in eastern Texas. That's mainly on the short term. In the next 2 weeks to a month, we'll see some wetter conditions. And then the dry conditions that were forecast in the southwest should actually play into some potential drought development in Arizona and New Mexico and into West Texas. So that's all I have. Back to John.
All right, thanks so much, Matt. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question, if possible. Operator, could you please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
Absolutely. To ask a question from the phone, please press star followed by the number one. Please make sure to unmute your phone to record your name at the prompt. Again, star one for any questions. One moment, please, while questions come through. And the first question comes from Tony Briscoe from the Chicago Tribune. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you guys for taking my call, and thank you for having this call on temperature trends. My first question I was hoping would go to Karen. I was wondering, just historically, how does the warming trend that we've seen for the upper Midwest and the Great Lakes region compare to what we're seeing, I guess, throughout the rest of the country? I guess I've heard historically that northern areas are more prone to warming faster or warming at a faster rate, and I was wondering if you might be able to explain the science behind that. And for Eric, I had another question. Just given the warming trend that we're seeing in the Great Lakes region, I was wondering if you could kind of talk about the interplay between warming air temperatures, Great Lakes water temperatures, and ice cover that we're seeing.
So, Tony, this is Karen. Is your question referring to as we move into spring, or are you talking about winter time warming?
Well, I guess, is there a warming trend that we're seeing that's more prevalent? Is it more pronounced, in a particular season such as winter?
Well, we are seeing wintertime temperatures warming faster than summertime temperatures. We're seeing overnight low temperatures warming faster than daytime temperatures, and that's just in general and not region-specific.
a warming trend for higher latitudes or northern areas, just over time?
I would have to get back to you on that and look specifically region by region to see what those trends are. I know the general trends, but not specific to the northern plains in particular. So if you'd like for me to dive into that a little bit, I could look into that and get back to you today.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, great.
The next question comes from Darna Noor from Gizmodo. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you so much for this. My question, I guess, is for Matt Rosenkranz, but others definitely feel free to chime in. I'm curious, you mentioned that we'll see above normal precipitation levels from the Mississippi Valley to the East Coast from March through May, it sounds like. Could you just contextualize that a bit in terms of the floods that we're seeing right now in Mississippi and how that could, what will that mean in terms of spring flooding in that area?
So this is Matt Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. We are forecasting above normal precipitation, as you said, from the Mississippi to the East Coast. I will remind that the official NOAA flood outlook is coming out in middle of March. That'll be released in conjunction with the National Water Center and the River Forecast Centers. Above normal precipitation in the east would kind of set the stage for continued flooding, especially because there isn't a lot of drought there. There's a lot of good soil moisture, so anywhere the rain does fall, there's not a lot of capacity for it to go in the soil. Soil moisture values are quite elevated across the eastern U.S., from the Mississippi Valley to the East Coast. There's a little pockets of dryness in, like, Missouri into Kansas, but basically east of there, it's been a quite wet winter. It's also been warm as well, so we've had a lot of liquid rather than snowfall, which sits on top of the soil and is kind of a slow recharge of soil moisture. So it would set the stage for the enhanced or elevated precipitation would set the stage for enhanced probabilities for flooding, for sure.
And we will go back to Tony from the Chicago Tribune. Just a moment, please. Looks like Tony is actually disconnected. So we'll move on to John Boyer from the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Your line is open.
Hi there. Thanks so much for doing this. This question is for Matthew on the March outlook. Unfortunately, my connection cut out very briefly right then. Can you recap the mechanisms leading to that expected below normal temperatures in the mid-Atlantic to southeast in March? And also expand, if you can, on what, if any, oscillations or regional patterns may be influencing that?
Sure. Again, Matt Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. The monthly forecast for March does have favored below normal temperatures, especially from the kind of mid-Atlantic down to the Gulf Coast. Those are linked to what we call tropical interseasonal oscillations, and specifically this one to the Madden-Julian oscillation. That can create a wave, what we call a wave train in the atmosphere, which is a systematic set of high and low pressures that develop in response to large areas of tropical thunderstorms. And when the large area of tropical thunderstorms are where they are now over the west central Pacific, right near the dateline, that tends to create a series of high and low pressures that would drive low pressure in the upper levels kind of over Hudson Bay and across kind of central Canada, and that allows for cold air to funnel down into the southeastern U.S., so that would set up a pattern that would favor below normal temperatures. And it looks right now to be very pronounced in the first week to two of March. And there could be some moderation for the second half of March. That same pattern would favor below normal precipitation across the Great Lakes and into the middle Mississippi Valley. As you drive the cold fronts across there, cold, dry air can typically, those kind of two things go together. And then behind, so that's the cold air behind the front, where the front would settle across the southeast, you'd get some above normal precipitation. The interesting thing is in the middle of there, where the fronts move across, so the mid-Atlantic region, you could tend to get you'll get rain with each front, so there's not a really good signal either for above normal or below normal precipitation. So therefore, we have equal chances across for precipitation across the Mid-Atlantic.
That's perfect. Thank you so much.
The next question comes from Martin Finucane from the Boston Globe. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi, Martin Finucane. Thank you for taking the call. This question is for Karen and then one for Matthew. For Karen, is this meteorological winter on pace to edge out the 2015-2016 season for the warmest winter in the lower 48? And for Matthew, can you just give a quick recap on the New England or Northeast outlook for March? Thank you.
This is Karen Gleason with the National Centers for Environmental Information. Looking at the first 2 months of meteorological winter, December and January, we're certainly on pace for that. I don't have a lot of information yet for February. That will really not be available for full analysis until the very beginning of March. So I'm not 100% sure how February will end up, but certainly it's something we're going to be looking at closely and reporting on. If it ends up warmest or even if it gets close to warmest, but the first two months of the 3 month period are on pace for that, and we're watching it closely.
All right, thank you.
Matthew Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. For the Northeast, the monthly forecast for March does favor below normal temperatures, basically for Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and parts of Long Island. The pattern would favor multiple cold fronts coming through the area, but it doesn't look especially stormy as far as resulting in a lot of precipitation. As we have equal chances for precipitation there. We've kind of seen that a lot this winter where we have these storms that kind of either go up the Ohio Valley and then bring either warm and wet to the East Coast, or they are just way far to the south, kind of like what we're experiencing today, and then they're kind of pulled off to the east. There's been like one or two good storms, nor'easters, but the pattern for March right now does not look especially conducive to a lot of precipitation, and therefore our monthly forecast for the Northeast is for no deviations from climatology. So whatever climatology was, that would be your best bet for March.
Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Henry Fountain from the New York Times. Your line is open.
Hi, this is for Karen. Can you just explain a little bit more why virtually certain that this year is going to be a top 10 year?
Well, what I can tell you is that we have probabilistic forecasts that we started creating just a little bit over a year ago. I believe November of 2018 is when we started doing that. Prior to that, we could only kind of anecdotally indicate, but the probabilistic forecast is based on the historical records and the distribution of the records. So we've seen in recent years, increasing temperatures being and annual temperatures being in the top 10. So just looking at that distribution and looking at probabilities based on where 2019 began in January, it's virtually certain that all of the runs with the probability put it in the top 10, or nearly all of the runs, and many, many thousands of runs are put together to create that probability. So it's purely based on the historical record.
Okay. I'm showing no other questions in the queue at this time.
All right. Thanks so much. If there are no further questions, I will wrap up the call. First, I want to thank all of our speakers for their time and everyone else for participating in this conference call. I will end by reminding everyone to mark your calendar for some upcoming releases from NOAA. The release of the February 2020 U.S. climate statistics is scheduled for March 6th. The release of the February 2020 global climate statistics is scheduled for March 13th. And the next media climate call will be NOAA's U.S. flood risk and spring outlook, which will be March 19th at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Again, that will be the U.S. flood risk and spring outlook, which will be March 19th at 11 a.m. Eastern. Finally, an audio file of this call will be posted in the media advisory on the NOAA.gov website later today. If you have any further questions or need any additional information, please email me at johnes-batteman@noaa.gov. My contact information is also available at the top of the media advisory. This concludes today's call. Thanks so much.
That does conclude today's call. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please allow a moment of silence for post-conference.